Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. In Washington, D.C., I'm Ron Elving.
And in Tallahassee, Florida, I'm Ken Rudin, courtesy of WFSU, member station.
And let me just say that, unlike the people in the Tour de France, no one in this podcast has been using any performance-enhancing drugs, as I'm sure the listener is aware. And also, probably, a lot of the people in politics right now would like to be able to get their hands on some of those drugs because they could use a little energy boost with just 2 weeks and a few days to go to the election.
Can you believe it's only like 19, 18 days to go? And that's remarkable because we're arriving at Election Day 2010, a completely different planet, let alone different election cycle, from Election Day 2008. Barack Obama was not a dirty word or dirty words back then. And now it's just remarkable how things have changed. And again, I'm not going to say what's exactly going to happen on November 2nd.
No, I think you're very strongly indicating that you believe that the full sweep is on its way and that all things Republican will triumph over all things Democratic
If you're saying, do I think that Republicans are going to take control of the Senate? I do not. If you're saying I think the Republicans will take control of the House, I do, but that's not a guarantee either. But it's just, we always talk about this, you know, the famous Kevin Phillips book, The Emerging Republican Majority, Karl Rove talking about the Republican domination forever. And when Barack Obama was elected in 2008 and sworn in January of 2009, it was the decades of Democratic rule of African-Americans, Latinos, young senior citizens, that coalition. And
yes, the young senior citizens are a very powerful voting bloc. No, you're exactly right. We have a tendency, the partisans have a tendency, and also the pundits have a tendency to regard every American election as the last one. We are never going to have another election. The pendulum is never going to swing back. And it's just not going to be true in our time because it's too much of a 50-50 country.
But what does the American people, what does the country get out of that? Do we have a better Congress? Do we have more legislation? Do we have more cooperation? I suspect that if anything, 2011, 2012 is going to be more of a nightmare, not because the Republicans will do better and the Democrats will have losses, but if nothing got done with basically one party rule in Washington, and that's exactly what we have now, at least numerically.
Well, nothing got done in the last 6 months, but previous to that, of course, a great deal got done, which is part of the reason why, you know, you find a lot of pushback from the country and Democrats in trouble, because they did pass a lot of legislation, and a lot of people have problems with some of that legislation.
They did, but they also did it on many party line votes. If 60 is the magic number in the Senate, well, if assuming that Democrats lose at least 7 seats, and that's my number right now, on November 2nd, then we're talking about 52 Democratic seats. What happens in the Senate? Well, who crosses party lines? Or is it just going to be every vote going to be 52-48 and not getting the 60 to pass anything substantial?
Well, I do think that when you said a moment ago that you didn't think the Republicans would take control of the Senate, I wanted to say, yeah, well, I don't think the Democrats are going to take control of the Senate either.
I don't
think either party is able to get anywhere near enough seats in an environment where there are no moderates. There used to be a certain number of people who would go back and forth, who would be willing to vote with the other party, not their own party. I just don't see that moderate band in there anymore. In fact, if let's say Mitch McConnell has 49 or 50 Republicans on his side and he looks like a very strong minority leader, is he in fact even in control of his own minority in the usual sense? If Jim DeMint, the senator from South Carolina who's been going around, you know, pushing for Tea Party challengers to more establishment Republican nominees, if Jim DeMint has 15 or 20 people who listen to him more than they listen to Mitch McConnell, what's Mitch McConnell going to be the leader of?
Exactly. I mean, we talk about how the Tea Party is so anti-Obama, but at the same time, we find in states like we saw it in Delaware, we saw it in Alaska, we saw it in Utah, that the Tea Party is also furious with this Republican establishment. We saw in Kentucky, too. There's an antipathy for the Republican establishment among these Tea Party folks. But I know that as conservative as many Republicans are who are already in the Senate, I think they're dreading or at least fearful of what 2011 is going to look like, because if Joe Miller wins, if Christine O'Donnell wins, and I'm not saying
Alaska
she will.
And Delaware.
Right, and Rand Paul wins, Ron Johnson, Wisconsin.
And
Sharon Angle
Ken
in Nevada.
Buck in Colorado. It just, exactly. The list goes on and on.
They don't owe anything to the Republican establishment. They owe nothing to Mitch McConnell, to John Cornyn, to the ways of Washington.
Well,
they want to shake up Washington,
right.
And that could mean shaking up Republicans as
and,
well.
And look, everything you're saying is legitimate, but let me also
what?
Throw in.
You never said that to me before.
Well, it's probably the first time it's been true. But then There is another way of looking at some of these Tea Party candidates. If, in fact, they do win, will Sharron Angle look around and say, hey, where did that $14 million in my third quarter fundraising all come from? Did it come in little $5 contributions from little Tea Party people somewhere in rural Nevada? I don't think so. I think that $14 million, and it's reflected across the country in race after race, Senate and House, some governorships, much of that money is coming from these new groups. Some people call them super PACs. Some people call them shadowy groups, and that's because they don't have to disclose who they are getting their money from in the usual older fashion because of the ruling from the Supreme Court and Citizens United, because of some rulings from the Federal Elections Commission, the FEC. These people are playing, and they're playing big time. And at some juncture or another, Sharron Angle will know to whom she owes something besides all those nice Tea Party people in Nevada.
Whether it's Citizens United, whether it's the Koch brothers, whether it's the uncertain funding of all these groups. I mean, money is always the mother's milk of politics, of course, but it seems like in 2010, it's more influential, more likely to change the results than I think in any kind of midterm election in my memory.
Well, I certainly think that in a case like Sharron Angle, where she was not a Meg Whitman, not a Carly Fiorina, not a wealthy woman, for her to suddenly have double-digit millions in a state with just one, really one and a half media markets, where it's very easy to flood the television airwaves. This is not an ordinary case of an insurgent candidate who rose up, defeated the establishment, and now owes nothing to anyone. And I think we're going to see that played out in a number of House races as well. I would take Ohio, for example, where you just were earlier this week. We knew there were three Democrats in Ohio in real serious trouble, Driehaus, Kilroy, and Boccieri, all pretty much considered to be goners, I think, by a lot of folks. But now the Republicans think they can get Zach Space, too. And Zach Space is suddenly getting, well, he is about to get hit with a big avalanche of this exact kind of money that's not coming from the Republican candidate and not coming from the Republican National Committee, but coming from a group like Karl Rove's American Crossroads or one of those outfits.
And that's why there are groups like the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, that has decided to pick and choose where they want to make their last stand in their desperate attempt to hold on to the House. So in Ohio, I was just in Columbus with WOSU, and it looks like Mary Jo Kilroy in the 15th District is gone. It looks like Steve Driehaus in the 1st District around Cincinnati is gone, but they are shifting their money to Boccieri, to Zach Space, because they feel they have a better chance of winning. It's remarkable how many Democrats who have really put their neck on the line in many cases by voting for health care, the overhaul bill, things like that, and yet they feel that in this political climate, the DCCC may have to abandon them because they just don't have a chance of holding onto their seats.
Triage, I think they call it. Somebody has to be left to bleed to death on the battlefield if you're going to have any chance of rescuing those who still have a chance to live. So the Democrats are definitely in that kind of mode. Let's talk about some of the big state races that are getting a lot of attention and that obviously are the most important ones on November 2nd. You're in Florida, Ken.
Well, both races are both the gubernatorial race where Charlie Crist is giving up the governorship to run for the Senate. What's fascinating about this Senate race,
George Lemieux was the appointee for Mel Martinez, who retired early.
Right. And Charlie Crist appointed him as a caretaker. Listen, George, you've been my lifelong pal. Hold the seat for me until I get elected. Everybody was convinced 2 years ago, or even less than that, that Charlie Crist would be the next senator from Florida.
Yep.
And that famous embrace that Charlie Crist had with President Obama when Obama came down to Florida to push for the stimulus program, if anything, that was a stimulus for Marco Rubio,
yes,
who was basically an afterthought, a conservative former state House speaker, became the overwhelming frontrunner for the Republican primary, so much so that Charlie Crist left. Now, for the longest time, we thought, well, maybe if Charlie Crist, running as an independent, and Marco Rubio, the Republican, split the Republican vote, Kendrick Meek, the African-American congressman from Miami, has a shot at winning. But what's happened is that it looks like that Charlie Crist is now fighting Meek for Democratic votes. A lot of Democrats are suddenly backing Charlie Crist. And if anything, that's the best news that Marco Rubio can get.
So Charlie Crist is really going to be an interesting kind of debrief after this election is over. He is going to have to look back over the last 2 years and try to figure out why he became the poster child for everything that changed in American politics. Who knows, maybe he'll get a job in the Obama administration. For his last 2 years, he's not got a future, I'm afraid, in the Republican Party. And down in Florida, of course, the Republican Party is in something of a meltdown over some of these scandals that surround the Republican Party of Florida as it was run in the past, and who's responsible and how much
right,
is it Charlie
Greer.
Crist.
Right, Jim Greer, the former Republican Party chairman who was very close with Charlie Crist, was in a lot of ethical problems. And, you know, that could affect the governor's race, too. We always focus in Washington on senatorial races, but with the census coming up, with the redistricting coming up, with the changing of the electoral college votes numbers coming up for 2012, the governor's races are crucial in states like Florida, which will gain congressional seats, and in states like Ohio, which will lose congressional seats. Whoever controls the governorship and the state legislatures will redraw the lines for 2011 and beyond, and that could play a very big role, not only in who controls Congress, but the 2012 presidential election.
Now, of course, the top 10 most populous states are all choosing governors this year. You've already talked a little bit about Florida. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with Rick Scott and Alex Sink.
Well, Rick Scott is, again, one of those Tea Party folks who's a self-funded candidate, spent, I think, $60 million of his own money on this campaign. He beat the Republican establishment, Bill McCollum, in the primary. Once the primary was over, all the Republicans rallied behind Rick Scott because they desperately want to keep the governorship because of redistricting and other reasons. But he has a past. He was the CEO of Columbia HCA, which is the hospital chain that later paid a $1.7 billion fine for Medicare fraud. Now Scott has been exonerated for this. He's not apparently under any kind of investigation of that.
Exonerated from a criminal standpoint.
Right, but not political standpoint, because of course in politics, perception is reality. And Alex Sink, chief financial officer for the state of Florida. If elected, she'd be the first female governor. She's kind of a lackluster campaigner. I don't think she's a very good campaigner, and I think a better campaigner would have put Rick Scott away by now. But again, it's a very, very close race. I think Scott is really on the defensive over the Columbia HCA stuff, but he's a good campaigner. He's folksy, and he has a ton of money.
And he is spending money freely at a time when Alex Sink is barely on the air in some parts of the state.
That's correct, and yet the race is still dead even. So you can talk about all you want about how money plays a big role. I mean, look, Meg Whitman has spent $140 million in California, for example, and yet she's still dead even at best with Jerry Brown, who has spent far less than that.
Well, I was going to say, Rick Scott's $60 million sounds like a lot of money, but Meg Whitman would call that chump change.
That's exactly right. But
the race in California has taken some strange turns. Now, she is hugely outspending Jerry Brown to the point where that's probably one of the better issues for Jerry Brown, is that he can talk about how much money she's spending and how little he has. But there was the turn that it took when Meg Whitman was found to have had an illegal nanny before she fired her in the summer of 2009. That story continues to some degree to percolate and be a problem for her campaign. But in the debate this week between Brown and Whitman, that was barely mentioned. And the new issue between them is this incident where one of the people participating in a conversation of aides and advisors to Jerry Brown suggested, and this got recorded inadvertently, that they refer to Meg Whitman as having been a whore for a union that she was trying to get an endorsement from. This comment got out. He apologized for this three times in the debate.
It's unfortunate. I'm sorry it happened. I apologize, Ms. Whitman.
So, Jerry, it's not just me. It's the people of California who deserve better than slurs and personal attacks. That's not what California is about. It is not our better selves.
But also took it back to her and said, well, let's talk about what you were doing with that union. Let's talk about the time that Pete Wilson, who's endorsed you, that's the former governor of the state, Pete Wilson, the time that he referred to people as whores.
Have you chastised your chairman, Pete Wilson, who called the Congress whores to the public sector unions?
You know better than that, Jerry. That's a completely different thing. The fact that you are defending your campaign.
So this has really become a focus of the conversation in California.
Well, the term whore for the insurance industry, for the pharmaceutical industry. We've heard that before. When it's directed at a woman, there are sexist connotations there. And I think that Brown looked like to be on the defensive on that. And it's just remarkable, the fact that, you know, you have all these problems in California with the school system, with the budget problems, and we're focusing on, between nanny whore, I thought I was watching Chinatown with Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway.
But the bigger the issues and the more difficult the problems, the more likely the campaign is to devolve in that way, right? Because nobody wants to talk about what has to be done in California because it's just too hard to contemplate, too horrendous. Back in your home state, the debate is being conducted on a much higher plane about the real problems facing the state of New York.
Homos.
Oh, thank you, Carl Paladino. No, look, I mean, Carl Paladino, the Republican nominee in New York, went on this diatribe in front of an Orthodox Jewish group about brainwashing children to think that heterosexuality and homosexuality were equal choices and there was really no difference.
I just think my children and your children will be much better off and much more successful getting married and raising a family. And I don't want them to be brainwashed into thinking that homosexuality is an equally valid or successful option. It isn't.
It was bizarre. He apologized for it, whereupon the Orthodox rabbi who had invited him to the group withdrew his endorsement.
But then Paladino went on to say how marching in a gay pride parade is disgraceful and subverting morals.
Because Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic nominee, had marched in a gay pride parade with his daughters.
I think we like to focus on the Carl Paladinos and the Christine O'Donnells of the world because they're a great copy, even though this race is not close. Because New York is another state, like California, where the issues are terrible. Albany is completely dysfunctional. The state legislature doesn't know what the heck it's doing. They have terrible budget problems. And so if the next governor of New York is going to be either a Carl Paladino who just, says these things that are just so beyond impolitic.
You'd think he was on a podcast.
Exactly. And yet, we've said this before, the latest poll, I think it was Marist poll, that showed that 59% of New Yorkers have a very unfavorable view of Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, so get higher once he's the governor.
I mean, don't you remember 1958, Nelson Rockefeller and Averell Harriman?
That was such an inspiring contest.
Remember you and I used to talk?
We were handing out leaflets, I think, for both candidates. That was what kind of race it was. But let me just say that while we're focusing here a lot on some of the gaudier campaigns and the bigger states, two very small states with just a couple, three congressional seats each may very well decide which party controls the Senate in the 112th Congress next January. And I'm talking here about West Virginia and Nevada.
Well, let's go to West Virginia first. This is a state that has not elected a Republican to the Senate since 1956. This is a seat that Robert Byrd held for 50 years before his passing in June. This is a seat that Joe Manchin, the very popular governor, was assumed to be a clear favorite, as Charlie Crist was in Florida.
Oh, he's a popular governor, and Charlie Crist had sort of lost being a popular governor. Joe Manchin is still, at this moment, a very popular governor. That's part of his problem.
Well, part of the problem is that he represents the Obama Party, and as you've pointed out, Ron, in last week's podcast, Barack Obama has never been popular in West Virginia. It wasn't popular in 2008 when Obama was at the peak of his popularity, and certainly it's less so in 2010. And so John Racey, the Republican millionaire businessman who's running against Manchin, is trying to portray the Democrat as an Obama clone.
We can't afford Joe Manchin in the Senate as a rubber stamp for Barack Obama.
I'm John Racey, and I approve of this message because I won't be a senator that's a rubber stamp to Barack Obama.
Even though on paper it's a Democratic state, it has voted Republican for president the last three times. Bill Clinton was the last Democrat to win the state in a presidential race. And again, as Bill Clinton said when he was campaigning for Joe Manchin, he said, look, if the economy weren't in such bad shape, Manchin would be winning this by 30 points, and he's right.
The Nevada race, Reid and Engel, about to have a debate. Perhaps that will be decisive. That's one that may keep us up on election night.
If I were a Democratic strategist or a Democratic advocate, I wonder if, given the fact that the best case scenario for the Democrats will be 52, 51 seats in November. They could even lose their majority, but I suspect they have a narrow majority. Is Harry Reid the guy you want leading the Democratic argument on the TV, on the floor of the Senate? I kind of suspect that Dick Durbin, his deputy, is a far more effective person, a better street fighter, more aggressive partisan.
If Dick Durbin does not get that job by inheritance, he's going to have to win a vote almost surely against Chuck Schumer.
I don't think so. I really think that if Reid loses, I think it is Durbin's to keep. But I kind of think that as horrific to many Democrats as the thought of Senator Sharon Angle might be, I just wonder if losing Harry Reid would not be the worst thing in the world for the Democrats.
Are you talking about somebody sitting in an office somewhere in Washington or on the West or East Coast? Or are you talking about a Democrat in Nevada? Because if you're a Democrat in Nevada and you appreciate that Harry Reid has, among other things, slowed the Yucca Mountain Project as being the repository for all the nation's high-level nuclear waste, if you appreciate what Harry Reid has brought to the state in any other respect, you would look at Sharon Angle, who is every bit as wacky a Tea Party candidate as there is anywhere in the country. And not every Tea Party candidate is out there, but some of them are out there. I mean, the people who would say things like we should get rid of Social Security, or Social Security was a mistake, or I don't know how I feel about Medicare.
64 Civil Rights Act?
Yeah, I mean, these are positions that in the very recent past have been considered outside the mainstream and outside of the Tea Party energy of 2010 are still outside the mainstream, in my view. And if you are a Democrat in Nevada, it seems to me you don't want that representation for the next 6 years. If you're a Republican or an independent, you may well. But if you're a Democrat in Nevada, do you really say, I think Dick Durbin would be a better national spokesperson for the party?
I am saying that if I were a national Democrat, I think that perhaps having Dick Durbin rather than Harry Reid would be a better thing. But if Harry Reid were that effective in Nevada, and if Sharon Angle were such a, you know, portrayed as somebody really outside the mainstream, explain to me why it's a dead even race.
Because there are not enough Democrats in Nevada to save Harry Reid. He has won in the past, not on just being a favorite among Democrats, but on having a broader appeal outside the hardcore Democratic base. But if you're talking about the kind of people who care who the party spokesperson is for the Democratic Party at the national level, those are hardcore Democratic base voters. And those people are going to be with Harry Reid. He's losing because Republicans and independents so outnumber Democrats in the state of Nevada.
I don't think so. I mean, look, President Obama carried Nevada pretty comfortably in 2008.
Again, on independent votes. And those very people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008, both in Nevada and lots of other places, are breaking Republican 60-40, 70-30 in this year's statewide contest and in a lot of House races as well.
I'm just saying, with less than 3 weeks to go before the election, the fact that we cannot call a winner, or at least not predict a winner between Reid and Angle, is just one of the more fascinating, unbelievable stories of this very unbelievable year.
And on that point, I think we would completely agree. And I think we can also agree on one other thing. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Ken, continue to enjoy Florida.
But I'll be back in Washington next week.
And that's another reason to join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. The best things in-